Welcome to Wise Counsel, a podcast interview series sponsored by MentalHelp.net, covering topics in mental health, wellness, and psychotherapy. My name is Dr. David Van Nuys. I'm a clinical psychologist and your host. On today's show, we'll be talking about EMDR, or eye movement desensitization reprogramming, with my guest, Dr. Francine Shapiro. Francine Shapiro, Ph.D., is the originator and developer of EMDR, which has been so well researched that it's now recommended as a frontline treatment for trauma in the practice guidelines of the American Psychiatric Association and those of the Department of Defense and of Veteran Affairs. Dr. Shapiro is a senior research fellow at the Mental Research Institute in Palo Alto, California. She's also executive director of the EMDR Institute in Watsonville, California, and founder and president emeritus of the EMDR Humanitarian Assistance Programs, a nonprofit organization that coordinates disaster response and pro bono trainings worldwide. She's a recipient of the International Sigmund Freud Award for Distinguished Contributions to Psychotherapy, of the City of Vienna and the Distinguished Scientific Achievement in Psychology Award presented by the California Psychological Association. She was designated as one of the cadre of experts of the American Psychological Association and Canadian Psychological Association Joint Initiative on Ethno-Political Warfare, and has served as advisor to a wide variety of trauma treatment and outreach organizations and journals. She has been an invited speaker at psychology conferences worldwide and has written and co-authored more than 60 articles and chapters and books about EMDR, including eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, basic principles, protocols, and procedures, EMDR, the breakthrough therapy for overcoming anxiety, stress, and trauma, EMDR as an integrative psychotherapy approach, and the Handbook of EMDR and Family Therapy Processes. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Francine Shapiro, welcome to Wise Counsel.
Well, thank you for having me.
You are the developer of an approach to psychotherapy known as EMDR. Can you describe that treatment for our audience and how it works?
Well, it's a form of psychotherapy that blends a variety of different elements, and the primary purpose of it is to identify the memories that people have that are causing them problems. We don't even necessarily realize how feelings of not being good enough or feelings we have of depression or failure, etc., are really based on earlier memories that are stored in the brain. And whenever something in the present happens that's similar, it can trigger thoughts and feelings and emotions that were there at that earlier time. And so what we're really doing is fighting the past. And what EMDR does is help to access those memories, identify them with the client, and to process them so they're digested, if you will, and what's useless is incorporated, and people learn from it, and what's useless, the negative feelings, the negative emotions, the negative thoughts are all able to be discarded.
It almost sounds a little bit Freudian when you talk about the impact of the past and feelings that are left over from the past.
Well, in Freudian psychology, there is a notion that there are these earlier events that have had an impact, and certainly I would say that just about any form of psychotherapy would agree that things that happened to us in the past have had an effect on us. But where EMDR is different from other forms of therapy is that we're looking at it as the memory itself is stored in the brain, and because it was not able to be processed. We have an information processing system that's geared to take in all of the information around us and link it up with the memories we already have to be made sense of. And so if we have a fight with someone at work, we can get disturbed, and we can our bodies get disrupted and we have negative thoughts and, you know, we get shaken up by it. But then we walk away and we think about it and we talk about it and we go to sleep and we dream about it. And the next day it doesn't bother us any longer. We recognize, oh, he was having a bad day, or, oh, I've had other good experiences with him. And so we decide what we're going to do, and the negative feelings are able to go away. But sometimes things can be so disturbing that they disrupt this normal processing, and the event is held in the brain and is stored in memory in the form that we experienced it. And so, for instance, whether it be a rape victim or something that might have happened to us in childhood, it really gets locked in the brain unprocessed. So it has those emotions and physical sensations that continue to emerge. So where within Freudian psychology, they might ask you to talk about it over a long period of time to arrive at insight about it, or where cognitive behavior therapy might say, give tools to try to deal with the disturbance when it comes up. In EMDR, we actually go in to access the memory and stimulate that information processing system so that it becomes processed and it is no longer disturbing. So we don't have to worry about it being triggered by things in the present, those feelings of not being good enough or not being able to succeed, or I'm going to be abandoned, or I'm not lovable. All of that is basically gone.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, we know so much more now about the brain and about brain processing than Freud did, or that people knew in Freud's time. And so there's a lot more specificity that's coming to pass around these kinds of processes. You referred to rape, and I'm under the impression that initially, when you developed this, you were really targeting it towards people who had suffered from rather distinctive traumas, such as rape. Is that right?
Yes. Initially, in wanting to test it out in research, we'd look at a diagnosis of people that would be clearly disturbed by old memories, and that would be rape victims or combat veterans or accident victims, the types of very large events that you would need in order to diagnose post-traumatic stress disorder, which has been in the news quite a lot, of course, because of the Iraqi and Afghanistan war. And so when I originally tested the EMDR, I used that population. But what we've discovered over time is that it's really not limited to those major events. It can be just about any kind of event that we have that has left a lasting negative effect upon ourselves would be called by dictionary definition a trauma. And so the more ubiquitous kinds of events, the kinds of things of childhood humiliations or shaming, or maybe having had a learning disability early on and having that sense of not being good enough, or being humiliated by amongst a group of people might leave us unable to deal with groups in the present, or not able to socialize, or being pushed away by parents at different times might give us a sense of not being secure and potentially of being abandoned or not being able to count on anyone. Those types of experiences, which are much more common, can really be at the bottom of a variety of different problems that people have, you know, from just self-esteem problems to depressions or different types of chronic pain. So it really has a wide range of application.
Yes, I've been looking at a couple of books on EMDR, and I was really surprised to see just how widely it has spread in terms of being able to target a wide variety of mental health problems, if you will, you know, having grown from that initial focus on trauma. And I, you know, let's step back a moment. I think the most distinctive thing about EMDR, at least from the title, you know, it's eye movement desensitization reprocessing. And it's that eye movement. That's when I first heard about it, and I got a very rudimentary description. You know, somebody said, well, the therapist moves their finger back and forth in front of the person's eyes, and their eyeballs track that finger movement. And so I'm kind of interested in that piece of it. How did you get onto that piece of it?
Well, it actually happened back in 1987. I was walking along one day, and I noticed that disturbing thoughts I was having were suddenly disappearing. And I hadn't done anything in order to cause them to go. It was the kind of thoughts you usually had to try to deal with to get them to not bother you. But I found they were just disappearing. And when I went to bring them back, they just didn't have any charge anymore. And so I wondered what had been going on, and I started paying very careful self-attention. And I noticed that when that kind of thought came to my mind, my eyes spontaneously started moving in a certain way, very rapidly. And I noticed, again, the thought shifted, and when I brought it back, it didn't have the same charge. So then I wanted to see if it would work deliberately, so I brought up something that bothered me and moved my eyes in the same way, and found that it had the same effect. And then I went to see if it would work with other people. And during that time of experimenting with it, I would find that for most people, there would be some change, but then it might stop. And so I had to develop a set of procedures around it to maximize the effect. And that set of procedures over these past 20 years has now become a form of psychotherapy in its own right, and the eye movement is one aspect of it. It's believed by certain researchers that it links into the same processes that occurred during rapid eye movement sleep, and during that period of time, it's felt that people process experiences that they've had during the day. But once again, we see that, for instance, a combat veteran who's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, instead of the dreams resolving problems, they often wake up in the middle of a nightmare. It seems like the disturbance is too high and disrupts the REM state. So the notion is that in the therapist's office, we're able to bring the person further along than they would be able to occur in the natural dream state. And so it's a very rapid movement of the memories to one where they simply aren't bothering you any longer.
That's fascinating. I didn't realize that it had been linked theoretically to the REM state and the rapid eye movement that's associated with sleep. That's really fascinating to me to hear, because I had intended to ask you, well, what do you think might be the underlying neural or brain processes? And I think you've addressed that. I have to say, when I first heard about this, you know, and I told you it was kind of, you know, one of my colleagues, I think, or a student maybe who was exposed to it was describing it, my initial reaction was pretty skeptical, and I gathered that you encountered some skepticism along the way. What was the initial reception, by the way?
Well, it was varied. There were some people who were open to it. Joseph Wolpe was one of the fathers of behavior therapy.
Yes.
And he was actually quite open to it. And
I was I immediately thought of him as I was reading about the system. But go ahead. I'll come back to that.
Right. He introduced it to the Association for the Advancement of Behavior Therapy as a breakthrough back at that time. But then others were quite skeptical because they didn't believe that anything could be that rapid. At the time I published the first controlled study of it, it was reporting effects with a single session in being able to reduce the distress that people had with their memories. And so people were quite skeptical that anything could work that rapidly or that well. And there were talks, well, it's just placebo, where it's nonspecific effects. And so over time, though, over these past 20 years, there are now close to 18 randomized controlled studies of EMDR. And in comparison to other forms of therapy for trauma, for instance, cognitive behavior therapy, you might be looking at the same type of symptom reduction, but it would take 40 to 100 hours of homework in the cognitive behavior therapy in order to achieve the same results. And what we're looking at is the application to, at this point, to, as we mentioned, a wide variety of problems that seem to be quite susceptible to treatment where other forms of therapy have failed. For instance, we have a recent study on the treatment of phantom limb pain, and of course that has application to combat veterans and many accident victims who lose limbs. And you can have up to 70 to 80% with pain. And people used to believe that it was nerve damage, and the treatment for it, medical treatment for it, was often cutting up the limb to try to get beyond it, but with very limited success. And what we found is that the pain that the person is feeling is really, once again, that stored memory of the accident that actually has the pain sensation stored in the brain. And once we use EMDR to process it, the pain is able to disappear. And I think that's extremely important, because what it points out is that many people who are suffering from different types of chronic pain do not have to be suffering with it. There really is a way of dealing it that doesn't involve monitoring it to try to feel better or pain medication.
Wow, that is really exciting, because I'm under the impression that up to this point, treating phantom limb pain has been fairly intractable, except through medication. So yes. That's very exciting. Well, I believe that I've given an oversimplified description of how it works, and I know that you've developed quite a protocol that has a number of distinct steps. Maybe you could just kind of take us through what those steps are.
Well, there are eight distinct phases in the treatment. One is taking a thorough history to identify what are the earlier memories that are the basis for the client's problems, whether it be the self-esteem issues or specific diagnoses. What are those earlier memories? And the person might not be aware of the links, but the therapist is trained to assist the client in identifying those. And we identify the earlier memories that set the groundwork for the problem and the current situations that cause the disturbance. And then we identify what the person might need to learn for the future. Different social skills, for instance, or family therapy skills, or any number of things that might not have been learned that are necessary. So those are identified during the history taking. And then there's a preparation phase where the client learns certain self-control techniques so that they know that they can stop the disturbance when they choose, whether it's during the session or in between sessions. And this is kind of a bridge, you know, to make life more tolerable while the therapy is taking place. Because the goal is to use the processing of EMDR to make sure that these disturbances don't come up again. But the preparation phase really sets the groundwork so the client can stay with the memories for the brief amount of time needed without undue distress. And then during the assessment phase, we bring up whether it's the memory or the current situation or the future template that's needed, and identify different aspects of it, the image, the negative belief that the person might have, I'm not good enough, I'm not in control, I'm not safe, whatever it might be, and then the positive belief that they would prefer to have, and the emotion that they're experiencing when they bring up the memory, and where they're feeling it in their body, and we take different scales of that so that we know precisely where the person is at the beginning of that treatment session. And then the next three phases are the reprocessing phases, where it actually allows the client's own brain to go where it's necessary in their memory network. So the clinician doesn't need to or try to supply the answers for the client or to lead the client, because the connections that the person has in their own memory system is the one that's necessary to really bring it to a finished state. So the clinician is there more as a facilitator to guide the client when necessary, but to allow them to do the processing that's necessary for them, with attention to the emotions that they, negative emotions they have, and then the thoughts they might have, and then the physical sensations. And at the end of that, the three reprocessing phases, there's traditionally a closure phase at the end of each session to make sure that the client is walking out feeling good about themselves and empowered. And then a reevaluation phase opens up each of the next sessions in order to make sure that the memories are, how they're feeling now, and to really guide the clinician through the different protocols, because there are different protocols for substance abuse, for chronic pain, phobias, etc. So the reevaluation phase allows the clinician to know what steps to take. And the thing is that during EMDR therapy, it's very accountable in that the client will generally be able to feel different changes, experience different changes from the very beginning of the reprocessing phases. And so they're getting feedback at every session of how it's progressed. It's not the type of thing where you have to wait months or years to find out whether it's going to be better or not. You know it from the beginning.
Okay. Yes, I mentioned that I was quite, as I began to read up on it, I really thought of Wolpe's systematic desensitization, except with the eye movement seemed to be a new element, and the SUD scale, or subjective units of distress scale, where you ask people to rate on a scale of 0 to 10 how aroused or fearful or panicked or whatever they're feeling in the moment. So I can see why Wolpe would have gotten quite excited about what you're doing. And I see the similarity. I'm not trying to reduce it to say that you haven't made an original contribution here, because I think that you have. I know there were some critics who questioned whether the eye movement was in fact adding anything specific to the effectiveness of the treatment. And you report on some recent research that seems to counter that criticism. Maybe you could share that with us.
Yeah, well, the problem was that the earlier research that had been done on the eye movement was really not good science, as the last practice guidelines for the International Society for Traumatic Stress pointed out. There weren't enough subjects in the different studies, or they used inappropriate clients. For instance, they were trying to check on the effect on post-traumatic stress disorder measures with combat veterans when they had only treated one memory, when these folks, of course, have quite a bit more memories to treat. So because it was bad science, it gave the indication that the eye movements did not have an effect. But since that time, since 2000, all of the studies that have emerged have supported the eye movement. There are about 8 randomized controlled studies that tested the eye movement in isolation, and they found that it has an effect on the vividness of memories and on the distress that people have. Others have indicated that it does seem to link into processes during REM sleep. They have studied it in terms of working memory. So, and most recently, physiological studies have shown that the eye movement itself seems to cause a relaxation, automatic relaxation response. So the notion of it being able to have an effect has clearly been demonstrated. I just want to mention one other thing that in terms of the desensitization. I actually did initially call it eye movement desensitization, because that's what I thought was happening, that desensitization in behavioral terms is to reduce the anxiety or distress.
Yes.
That a person has associated with something. But I eventually added reprocessing on, because I felt that the desensitization is really only one thing that's going on during the treatment. When you watch an EMDR session, you see the client coming to new insights, new understandings. Their whole demeanor changes. The physical sensations change. There's quite a bit more that's going on than simply taking away the distress from a memory. What you really do see is a rapid evolution towards health. So the problem with much research, of course, is that it only is measuring the overt symptoms that are involved in a specific diagnosis. But what we really see is quite a bit more than that occurring. And that's why if I had to do it over again, I would really just call it reprocessing therapy.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. You mentioned the physiological studies, and certainly there are new brain scan technologies that are greatly increasing our understanding of how the brain works. Has this technology shed any light on EMDR, or might it?
Well, there have been studies that have been shown SPECT scans, mm-hmm. as well as PET scans that have been done that have shown clear differences before and after EMDR treatment. And what they've shown is that there's the different areas of the brain light up or become calmed down. For instance, the limbic system, the one that was overactivated in terms of emotional distress, is calmed down, whereas other brain elements that involve more sense of presence or awareness are more greatly activated. There's a recent study that's actually shown growth in hippocampus after eight EMDR sessions, which is very interesting given the fact that a number of studies previously had shown that trauma has a negative effect on the hippocampus and actually shrinks it. So the notion was that for a time that post-traumatic stress disorder in chronic victims might be untreatable because there's actually organic brain change. But here we see that after EMDR therapy, there's actually an increase in hippocampus. So it's all quite fascinating, but of course, as with any form of psychotherapy, the whole area of neurobiology is so young that you can see pre-post changes, but one has no actual idea of what the mechanism was that caused it to occur.
Yes, yes. As I hear you talk about the approach, it brings up for me associations to other approaches, and it seems to me that there are elements in common with other approaches, that while it is a unique and important contribution, it's certainly not isolated from other things. And so I'm wondering what sort of connection, if any, do you see between things like psychodynamic insight therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy or the mindfulness approaches?
Well, I think that all truth dovetails, and mm-hmm. we're very happy to see that with EMDR, it's an integration of elements of these different therapies. For instance, there's a nice chapter that was written by Paul Wachtel on his view of EMDR and psychoanalysis, and what has been described as a free association process that occurs during EMDR, like free association at turbo speed. And so it's really able to go very deeply into an individual psyche to identify what the issues are and what the connections are in a way that's very understandable to those practicing psychodynamic therapy. And in EMDR, we do use negative and beliefs as they do in cognitive therapy. But the difference is, in cognitive therapy, there's the notion that the belief is the cause of the problem, whereas in EMDR we see the belief as a symptom of the problem, that the cause is the memory that's inappropriately stored. And once we process that memory, that negative belief changes to a positive belief, and we don't have to challenge it or deliberately try to get the person to think differently, but it happens automatically. And then in experiential therapy, we see it really as very client-centered, that the client is the one in the lead and it's not the therapist that has to give the answers. Indeed, the EMDR clinicians love doing the therapy very often because it's very much like a treasure hunt. You don't necessarily know what's going to come up, and it's a lot of it's recognizing that the client is really the one from which the answers are going to stem, and they do, you know, beautifully without the client having to talk a lot. I mean, it's not something that the rape victim has to delve into all the details of what happened, or the combat veteran has to tell you everything that occurred. It's something that's happening nonverbally. It's going on in the mind of the client. So the client can share what they would like to, but those who don't want to talk about it don't have to. And I think that that's a very important part, because I think a lot of people are kept away from therapy because they believe they're going to have to spend so many sessions talking about things that they don't want to. And in EMDR, it's simply not necessary.
Well, there used to be a belief that talking about it was good for you, say in the case of battle trauma, that if you talked about it, you would get it out of your system. But now some people are arguing, I believe, that, well, you might actually be sort of rehearsing it and making it stronger by reliving it. Do you have a position on that?
Well, I know there's a form of therapy called exposure therapy where the person needs to go over it in detail. So yeah. They'd be saying, I'm feeling the blood, and it all has to be in the present and in the eye, and there has to be that continued discussion of it or continued description of it over and over and over again, and then listening to audio tapes and then going to places where they were disturbed in order to overcome it. Now, it has a long history, I mean, in psychotherapy, and I think that the issue in terms of making people worse can be involved in the preparation or when it's tried with them. The research has indicated that when individuals are asked to do that type of thing, as they have incorrectly done in misuses of something called critical incident debriefing, when they've done it with individuals, mm-hmm. it has made the person worse, but that's really a misapplication because it was really supposed to be done in a group in a particular way. So yes, people can get hurt when therapies are misapplied, and therefore it's important to make sure that you go to a therapist who's clearly licensed and trained in whatever form of therapy they're doing and has a positive track record.
Yes, and you know, talking about the ways in which the approach EMDR has spread into a wide variety of applications. I think one of the ones that surprised me most was family therapy, because the way that I envisioned EMDR was very much a kind of one-on-one process. So that surprised me. How is it used with families?
Well, with family therapy, very often the concentration is on identifying what the problem is and trying to teach the family members different skills in ways of communicating so that they can deal with each other in a more positive way. But what we found very often is that the reason for the disturbance are the earlier memories that the person has that pushing them to feel that they might be abandoned by the spouse, that they are being not treated well, or they fear that they're not going to be treated well. And all of this, again, comes from these earlier memories that are pushing up. So if a spouse looks at them in a way that their father did before they got hit or had the sound of their mother's voice at a time that they felt that they were being intruded upon, then those emotions are going to be coming up, and they're going to be treating the spouse from that lens, from that sense of disturbance. And so what we do is process these earlier memories so the person is no longer pushed into being reactive. Because of course you hear so many times, I tried to, but I just couldn't control myself. And the reason that they can't control themselves is that these earlier memories are pushing those emotions and reactions. So processing those experiences first then leaves the groundwork open to learn the skills and be able to use them effectively because they're no longer being run by the past.
Okay. Well, let me ask you, are there any conditions for which EMDR would not be applicable?
Well, when things are purely organic, certain forms of depression may need medication. Certain forms of ADHD may need medication. But what we've often found is that when a child might be or adult might be diagnosed with ADHD, it really is mimicking the symptoms of it, but it's really these earlier trauma, these early events that are pushing it, that are causing the person not to be able to concentrate, etc. And so processing those events can drop the symptoms that cause them to be diagnosed with ADHD. If it was actually organic, though, EMDR would not stop those symptoms, but it could be used to address the feelings of I'm not good enough, I'm damaged, all of those negative feelings that the person has because of failure experiences that can be compounding it. So we really would be looking at what conditions are being pushed or contributed to by earlier memories, and if those are not there, then EMDR would not be appropriate.
How might a listener to this show gauge whether they should seek out this treatment?
Well, it's basically identifying what is it that's holding me back, what's pushing me to, you know, the things that I'm being pushed to do that I don't want to, are the things that I'm prevented from doing that I'd like to do. Do I have a sense of not being good enough, et cetera? And if those feelings are there, just recognize that very often they are the product of these earlier memories. And by accessing an EMDR clinician, they could find out in very short order whether therapy would be good for them. Because as I said, it's not the type of thing where you have to go through for months or years to find out if it's going to work. Just the history taking phase with the clinician can help identify whether EMDR would be appropriate for them.
Well, how would they go about finding an EMDR clinician?
They can access it through the EMDR Institute, which is at www.emdr.com, or the EMDR International Association, which is emdria.org. Would give a list of clinicians available throughout the United States.
That's great. Well, let me just close by asking you a personal question. I mean, here you were walking along the waterfront, dwelling on a personal problem, and you notice something. So many of the breakthroughs in science have come through some observation that other people had just overlooked that could have been available to any number of people, but somebody notices something, and you notice something that seems to have been very key. And it's kind of caught on and spread like wildfire. And there's a research literature, and there are training programs, and so much has been written about EMDR. So I'm wondering, what's it like for you now as kind of a rock star of psychotherapy?
Well, I don't feel like a rock star. I do feel very grateful to be a part of it. I mean, we have an EMDR humanitarian assistance program that has been able to do work of ethno-political violence throughout the world. They've been able to work with individuals who have been traumatized in a variety of ways, and it's bringing people together. For instance, we're able to work in a training program in Northern Ireland, bringing Catholic and Protestant clinicians together to actually work together and deal with the problems that came from the Troubles. We have trainings going on in the Middle East where Israeli facilitators have helped to train Palestinian clinicians. And the notion is that if we can help individuals overcome the effects of trauma, then it doesn't have to continue a cycle into despair and anger and violence. And knowing that that potential is there to bring people peace is just a wonderful feeling.
Oh, that's very fascinating set of direction there that would require a whole another interview. But we better wrap it up for today. So Francine Shapiro, thanks so much for being my guest today on Wise Counsel.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
I hope you found this interview with Dr. Francine Shapiro thought-provoking. As you heard in the interview, I was initially quite skeptical when I first heard of EMDR. However, I'm now convinced that enough research has been done and enough evidence of its efficacy has been collected for me, at least, to take this approach seriously. Let me repeat the two web addresses Dr. Shapiro gave out in case you wish to investigate this approach more on your own. They were www.emdr.com and internationally, www.emdria.org. I would also recommend her book, EMDR, The Breakthrough Therapy for Overcoming Anxiety, Stress, and Trauma, which is published as a paperback by Basic Books. You've been listening to Wise Counsel, a podcast interview series sponsored by MentalHelp.net. If you found today's show interesting, we encourage you to visit mentalhelp.net, where you can add a comment or question to this show's webpage, view other shows in this series, or simply page through the site, which is full of interesting mental health and wellness content. Access this show's page and show archive information via the podcast box on the mentalhelp.net homepage. If you like Wise Counsel, you might also like Shrink Wrap Radio, my other interview podcast series, which is available online at www.shrinkwrapradio.com, and wrap is spelled R-A-P. Until next time, this is Dr. David Van Nuys, and you've been listening to Wise Counsel.